Hello, and welcome to this week's podcast with me, Cleo Springer. This week, we're going to talk about five recent key employment law cases that concerned workers in the health sector. Though, as we'll see, many of the issues and what we can learn from the cases have wider application. I'm joined by Susan Dennehy, employment law editor, and in particular, editor of Expert HR's health sector content. So, Sue, if we start by looking at Brangwyn versus South Warwickshire NHS Foundation Trust, can you tell us about this case?
Yes, this is a disability discrimination case. The claimant in the case had a phobia of blood and needles. As it turned out, he also had a phobia of handling patients.
There are some exceptions to what amounts to a disability under the Equality Act, but is phobia covered?
A phobia is covered as a mental impairment as long as it has a substantial effect on normal day-to-day activities and it's also long-term.
And is there any government guidance on this?
Yes, helpfully, the guidance on the definition of disability specifically deals with phobias and says that it will be reasonable to regard as having a substantial effect if it restricts a person, for instance, if they have difficulty entering or staying in environments that the person perceives as strange or frightening. The odd thing about Mr. Brangwyn, of course, was that he worked at a hospital.
Well, perhaps you'd better tell us about his job then.
Well, it's not so odd when you learn that his job was providing therapy services in the form of a woodwork programme to patients at the hospital. With changes to patient care and rehabilitation being much quicker in hospitals now, he was coming into contact with patients still in the process of recovery and it was making him ill and stressed and he complained.
Okay, then what happened?
Well, the hospital agreed that there was no requirement for him to do the things he found difficult, but, and this was the substance of his complaint, this was never reduced into his job description. He brought a claim for failure to make a reasonable adjustment. The Employment Tribunal found that the issues he was complaining of could amount to a provision, criterion or practice, i.e. handling patients and going on to wards, but the Employment Tribunal and subsequently the Employment Appeal Tribunal found once that they were aware that he wasn't able to do these things, they didn't actually require him to do them, and the hospital had not failed to make a reasonable adjustment by not recording this in his contract for employment or job description, but noted that it was regrettable that this was never properly recorded, but he lost on that ground.
So employers should really make sure that any adjustments that they make or agree are formalised and set down, and if an employee has special arrangements confirmed formally, then they might feel more that they know where they stand and not feel so vulnerable.
Yeah, particularly in this case, it was obviously very important to him.
Okay, well the second case is also a disability case, in this case discrimination arising from a disability, and we are seeing more of these cases, it's worth noting.
Yes, the next case is Western Yorkshire Ambulance Service NHS Trust.
So in this case, a nurse working at a prison, she had a number of health problems, including osteoarthritis, which affected her mobility, and she'd been off sick for a long time, and she'd agreed to terminate her employment with the prison. And then she then applied to the Trust's 111 service, which was a much more sedentary role. So can you tell us what happened next?
Yes, she left her old job, as you said, and she applied to the 111 health advice line, and they made her employment subject to references. Her new employer got information from her old job at the prison very late in the day about her sickness absence, which had been very lengthy, I think up to 2 years, and the need for her to have reasonable adjustments in view of her osteoarthritis and her mobility problems. And they decided at the last minute to withdraw their offer of employment. She brought a claim alleging that withdrawal of the job offer constituted discrimination arising from disability under Section 15 of the Equality Act 2010.
Okay, well perhaps you'd better explain what Section 15 is about.
Well, Section 15 makes it unlawful for an employer to treat an employee unfavourably because of something arising in consequence of his or her disability, where the employer knows or could reasonably be expected to know that the employee has a disability. Withdrawal of a job offer would clearly, as you would imagine, be unfavourable treatment, but there is a defence if the employer can justify the unfavourable treatment.
And the employer in this case did try to justify the withdrawal of the job offer.
Yes, they did try to justify it on the basis that they needed a certain level of service to be provided at the 111 call centre, but the tribunal found the employer had based the withdrawal of the offer on the reference they'd received and the occupational health report that they received from the prison, basically that she'd been off for over 18 months on sickness absence, that she would need certain reasonable adjustments, including she would need to change her posture in her job because of her mobility problems. And they had jumped to the conclusion that she'd be no good because she would be too immobile for the job. And the tribunal was critical that they'd taken that view without any further investigation. Anyway, the reasons that they used to base that decision were all related to her disability, and therefore she succeeded in her claim.
Okay, well, your next case concerns whistleblowing, which for the health sector is a continuously developing area. But this case was really about who can bring a whistleblowing complaint and who they can bring it against. And the case is Day versus Lewisham and Greenwich NHS Trust and Health Education England. And it concerned a doctor working in a hospital who made a complaint about patient safety. So tell us a little bit more about this one.
Yes, Day and Lewisham and Greenwich is a case about Dr. Day, who was left to cover for other locum doctors who had not turned up for work for whatever reason, which included him having to cover patients in intensive care. He made a complaint about patient safety, essentially that he was expected to cover 18 beds when the maximum guidelines say he should have been only accountable to look after a maximum of 8 beds. His contract was not renewed subsequent to making that complaint, and he has to work as a locum, basically an agency doctor. He alleged that he'd been treated detrimentally by Health Education England, the body responsible for training NHS staff, and the Trust also, and he asserted that his treatment arose as a result of raising a protected disclosure, and he brought proceedings for unfair dismissal and detrimental treatment for whistleblowing.
Okay, well, his claim against the Health Education England was struck out, wasn't it? Why was that?
Health Education England had arranged his training placements, and they'd paid part of his salary, and they were responsible for reviewing his progress as a junior doctor. But his claim failed on the basis that he was neither a worker nor an employee with the Health Education England body, and therefore he could not bring a claim, and he wasn't protected. Dr. Day tried to argue under Article 10, which basically states that everyone has the right to freedom of expression and to impart information, but the Employment Appeal Tribunal held that whistleblowing was a statutory provision and Parliament had not included junior doctors in that legislation. Dr. Day could not bring a claim against the national training body, the Health Education England.
Quite specific facts here, but there is a potential wider implication for any organisation that finds itself on the receiving end of a whistleblowing claim. Is the claimant your employee or worker? And if not, apply to have the case struck out. As we said earlier, the NHS has been the focus for improving provisions around whistleblowing.
Yes, part of Dr. Day's complaint was that the legislation was extended to cover student nurses and midwives on the 6th of April 2015, but not student doctors. I think we can expect to see that changing sometime in the future. And there's also a new NHS whistleblowing policy for the NHS coming in on the 31st of March 2017.
And subscribers can find out more about that in our health sector content. OK, shall we move on now and look at your next case, which is a religious discrimination case, the case of Waceney versus East London NHS Foundation Trust, which concerns what's probably a not particularly uncommon scenario.
No, it sounds pretty typical, and it involved a senior occupational therapist who was a born-again Christian, and she was very enthusiastic about her new faith, and essentially the case was whether or not she had crossed the boundaries of what's acceptable in the workplace. Her co-worker made a complaint about her proselytising to her, and the Trust instigated disciplinary proceedings against Mrs. Waceney. She got a final written warning originally, which was subsequently reduced to a first written warning on appeal, but she wasn't happy about this and she decided to bring a claim of religious discrimination.
What was the basis for her claim?
Well, she argued that instigating the disciplinary proceedings against her was an act of harassment or direct discrimination on the ground of her Christian belief. The tribunal accepted that the reason disciplinary proceedings had been instigated was that Mrs. Waceney had subjected a junior employee to unwanted and unwelcome conduct that went substantially beyond religious discussion, and they drew a distinction between Mrs. Waceney's Christian beliefs and what was really her inappropriate conduct.
Okay, and the EAT upheld the decision in that case, didn't it?
Yes, they did.
OK. Well, that case is an example of the employer being able to take disciplinary action where the way the employee's shown their belief is inappropriate. But employers do need to be very careful that what they're taking action against is the inappropriate conduct and not the fact of the belief itself. But could this situation have been avoided in the first place, do you think? What can employers do to avoid being in a situation where they're defending a claim like this?
Well, it can be a fine line, can't it, in these situations. If you think it could be a problem in your workplace, you should make it clear in your internal policy what is permitted. And a quiet word once someone starts to go beyond what you think is acceptable might avoid disciplinary action later. And these sorts of situations can get very messy, so it's better to set out the parameters of what's acceptable early on.
Okay, well, the last case we're talking about today is one which we've very recently reported on Expert HR. And although the background to the case also concerned discrimination claims, other factors have rather taken over and are quite unusual.
Yes, indeed. It's Zia and others and Brighton University Hospital, and it's the case of four doctors working in a digestive department of Brighton University Hospital. They allege that they were subjected to race discrimination. The case was at the tribunal when the employer received an anonymous recording of the Trust's meeting with their lawyers, and that meeting had taken place immediately after a without prejudice meeting with those doctors. The Trust brought a case in the High Court regarding the breach of confidence, and the recording amounted to privileged information as it was a recording of the private part of a meeting, including their legal advice. The Employment Tribunal case by this time was in its ninth day when the employer heard that the High Court had granted the injunction to prevent it being used as it was privileged. So the employer applied and had the case struck out for unreasonable conduct, and the four doctors were ordered to pay £70,000 for the costs.
Okay, well, it's quite a specific situation, and incidents of employees covertly recording meetings, and in particular discussions between their employers and their legal advisers, aren't going to be common. But it is an issue for employers, though, isn't it, the recording of meetings? Employers need to be in control of this and to be sure about what their policy is. And if they don't want meetings recorded, they really should be making this clear.
Yes, and if you have any suspicions about secret recording devices being left in the room, and it's much easier now with recording devices being in almost everything, including phones, you should sensibly adjourn to another room for your private delivery. Deliberations. And I think it's timely that we will be publishing a new how-to on employees requesting to record meetings, which will be available on our website soon.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Sue. And before we go, I should just mention another NHS case, Garen McCanworth versus Solent NHS Trust. And this case concerned the right to privacy for emails and photos on an iPhone relating to a work colleague. And we discussed this case in a recent edition of the podcast, which you can download. And you can also access our health sector content via the topic tab on Expert HR. That's it for this week's podcast, which you've been listening to with me, Cleo Springer. We're back again next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.